Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Saturn Box podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host, explorer of the realms of madness, and poet, Mikala Ann. On this week's episode, we have guest Cooper of the Witch Hassle podcast, here to discuss the link between poetry and necromancy. We get into a bunch of other cool topics like language use, the intersection between the liminal, madness, and melancholy, as well as a bit of left politics on how one might create mutual aid through poetry. Is poetry ruled by the moon, Mercury, Saturn, or maybe all three? This episode was a complete delight and filled with much laughter on both sides. I hope you all find it as interesting as I did. And feel free to message me with any poems or stories of necromantic workings that included poetry so we can chat about it. If you find this podcast interesting and want to show some support, consider checking out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/Saturnbox. I can also be found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Saturnbox.
Hey, so I am the host of a little interview podcast called Witch Hassle, and I mostly stick within the wheelhouse of like necromancy and planetary sorcery and weird stuff with playing cards. But yeah, really happy to be here. Super psyched.
You are also a poet then. And is that something that you do separately from your magic work, or is it all kind of entwined?
I mean, it's funny because, like, the poetry, I think when I first started doing it, it was before I got into any of the occult stuff, and it was very occult as I started doing it. And as I've sort of focused more on sort of diving deeper and experimenting more with occult stuff, I've kind of left the poetry behind a little bit. But as it comes back, it's coming back with the same sort of fixations as the occult work. As much as one might try to like separate oneself from like poetry in the sense of like, I'm just going to make a poem, it has nothing to do with me. There's none of me in there. It's always in there.
And what do you call that sort of thing? A muse? Or is it a spirit that guides you? Like when you say the same fixations are there, what exactly do you mean by that term?
I mean, part of it's just like the same like emotional preoccupations, right? So like I wouldn't go so far as to say muse, but like a lot of the work I do in terms of poetry is really focusing on anxiety, which is like a really great muse inside the body. Like it's a constant whisper, very muse-like in that sense. There's a lot of focus on bringing back the dead in some way. Like the first book of poetry I ever had published was just a very long book, or like a very long single poem about, among other things, just like looking at necromantic practices from like the Middle Ages and thinking about how the things that leave us never quite disappear. And it's very easy to tie that in to the magical practices in terms of just like, not just like the content, but also just like the worldview that nothing is ever completely gone. No room is ever really empty.
I love that. So it's like the emotions that become trapped in our body, the anxiety that we experience through our felt sense is in some ways a ghost of the experience that we had in the past, which is why we feel that emotion trapped in us later on.
Yeah, we're riddled with that sort of thing. And I feel like poetry really is... Sorry, she loves to be included in everything. She demands it. Where was I? Yeah, I mean, because like the thing about poetry and also ghosts, I think, is also that so much of how you learn to do poetry is you have to read other poets, right? And you have to live with them. And so like when I was about, actually it would have been, yeah, I would not have moved back yet. So 10 years ago today, I was still living by myself in a studio apartment in Hong Kong and feeling like super isolated. And one of the ways that I kind of brought presences into the room was just to memorize poetry and then recite it. And when you do that, you're really giving space in your body for somebody else. You're really making your throat conform to the same shapes that somebody else did at some point in the past. And so in a lot of ways, you are giving over your body to a kind of voluntary possession through the poetry.
Wow, I love that perspective. So it's like we can use a dead poet's writing as sort of an invocation in the same way that, you know, one would in some sort of theurgic ritual, and in that way kind of call them to embody and inspire us.
Right. And I mean, like, it's also that weird thing is like when you start writing poems, especially if you've like been immersing yourself in somebody else's work, you'll find their tics finding their ways into what you're doing. And so you can't help but sort of, if not quote them, rhyme with their thoughts a little bit. But also, like, you'll have weird, like, I mean, I wrote like my thesis in college about this poet who was dead at the time and was sort of, I think, undiscovered. I mean, not undiscovered, but like didn't get enough attention. He deserved more attention than he got. And like, there's that moment where you suddenly have a dead poet coming to you in your dreams and you're like, and at the time I didn't have like the divinatory practice to be like, was this real? Was this fake? Which horn is this? You know, but like that idea of like, oh, I have accidentally called them forth for a moment to speak with me, or in this case, to stare at me as I sit grimly behind the two-way glass in an interrogation room. A lot of anxiety probably in that dream. College wasn't the most fun.
Is that what you did in Hong Kong? Was that studying abroad?
No. That was my first job out of college, basically, was tutoring in Hong Kong. And it was weird because I got offered the job and thought, oh, well, I've never lived anywhere near there and I'm 21. Why not? And it ended up being like this really nasty experience because of, you know, Hong Kong had been a British colony up until about 10 years before that. And they had just gotten their first like minimum wage, like statutorily, like a few years earlier. And like, there was still like this very intense neo-colonial ethos in the place. So the economic and racial dynamics were such that as like a white foreigner, I could not be there and not perpetuate a lot of like systems of oppression and stuff like that. It was like a very isolating experience, which is why I left very quickly. But before that, I was, you know, just like cooped up in my place a lot, just kind of like reading poems and like feeling bad, which is really, I think, the key to a lot of poetry is just feeling bad.
No, yeah, that's totally on the nose. When I think about the intersection between magic and poetry, oftentimes I think about the moon card.
Yeah.
And it's like one of those tarot cards that we love when we see it, but we like know that it's kind of bad.
Yeah.
In a way, it's about, to me, it's about having the ability to want to go into the underworld and explore those feelings and bring them out into the light. And I do view art of any kind as being one of the best ways to bring those dark feelings out from the underworld and into the light. Because there's positive and negative ways to do that, or a better way to phrase it would be healthy and unhealthy ways to do that. And I think transmuting our emotions instead of hyperfixating on them in an analytical way, which never actually solves anything with the lunar space, if we can detach our brain from thinking about it, but still allow the inspiration to flow through in an artistic way, there is healing in the feeling bad there.
Totally. Yeah. Especially because I think I mean, maybe an analytical route could do this, but I feel like that kind of emotional route is much better at objectifying the feeling into something outside of yourself, which means that you're allowed to put it down. You're like allowed to give it to somebody else. And also, I'm thinking about like a friend of mine is like this incredible scholar of the occult and such, Al Cummins, and he has a lot of really interesting things to say about, especially the humors and how they can relate to raising the dead, right? So like melancholy in particular is like the melancholy humors, the big talking to the dead humor. And if you look at like, say, Agrippa talking about melancholy, he's like, what's a melancholic person like? Well, they sigh all the time. They're lying down or something like that. And like, it's very much him just describing like the romantic idea of a poet. And so I feel like there is this also this strong connection between like the prophetic potential of melancholy and like the poetic need to sort of like find the unseeable truth within yourself.
It's funny that this is the second episode in a row that Al Cummins' work on the humors in particular has come up.
Really? Oh, that's great.
Yes. But just backtracking, what you were talking about in some ways reminds me of that movie Melancholia, because there is this idea of color and mood, which I think is a part of what a lot of occultists experience when we are involved in trance, mm-hmm. or we're talking to spirits of some kind. You have to learn how to find symbology in feelings and in tingling sensations on the body. And the sense that the moon in that movie is constantly getting closer and closer and closer to the world, it's making me think about how there is water in our body that as the moon gets closer, it can push and pull and push and pull. So being able to not necessarily intellectually detach from that, because especially with poetry, we are using words, but to like weave the intellect in and out of those spaces of emotions seems to be, in my mind, a lot of what ritual, magic, and occult is all about.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because, I mean, especially like, you know, that weaving, it's a great image for it. Because, I mean, with poetry, I mean, this is true with all other forms of writing, but especially with poetry, there is such a sort of, there are two tracks going on at the same time, right? There's the literal meaning of the words that you were saying. And then there is under that, the sort of deep kind of throbbing baseline of like whatever the words are doing sound wise, like what they're actually sort of, you know, there's the saying and then there's the doing. And I think like, especially like invocation is sort of like that same basic principle that you are saying something, but the point of the saying is to do. And like, especially if you're embodying something, like if you're doing like, say like the Picatrix invocation of Hermes, right? Or Mercury. And you're not just saying all these things about, you know, Mercury does this, he's so good at this, these are his attributes, but you're also doing it like incredibly quickly, right? Like your sentences are all just big long lists of things going by with the incredible speed of like a mercurial figure. It's like you're really, I think, in talking about you are becoming. And I think poetry really does sort of allow us to do that in a way that other forms of writing approach but don't quite do as well.
Would you mind expanding on why you think poetry in particular excels in that?
I mean, I think it's because with poetry, more so than the other forms, I think it really is the one that retains the idea of reading something. Oh, hello. Of reading something out loud, right? Like, I mean, we read stories to like kids and stuff like that. But a lot of the times I think reading has become a very silent affair and a very sort of, you know, not a lonely business, but a thing you do kind of hidden in the world between your temples there. And with poetry, there's much more of an idea that like, you're going to hear that. And so these words are going to be physical objects. And what are you going to do about the physical nature of a sound? And especially like how that can be your road into things. It's funny because like these days, I feel like since free verse is so popular in American poetry, people don't talk about meter or consonants or assonance in the same way, but it's all happening still. All that incredibly physical musicality is still happening, and like you are still sort of in the realm, like you're not too far afield from the idea of resonant frequencies, right? You know, if you play the tone just right on your oboe or what have you, you might be able to break the glass in the kitchen. And I think poetry is the closest we get to that, because there is still the sense that you're going to be hearing this, and it's still going to be like a physical vibration that is touching everything in the room and imbuing it with itself.
I love that imagery. It was making me think about the story of Hermes and Hermes making the lyre and then trading the lyre to Apollo to get himself out of trouble. So it's like this idea that if we take language, which Hermes also rules, and we add it to rhythm and syncopation and music, then we can trick even the sun, even the god of the sun. And that's, I think, why Mercury is a magician, because we kind of, just in the same way that sorcery is about getting spirits or deities to give us something that fate may not have allotted us generally, Mercury was able, through this idea of taking language and combining it with rhythm and syncopation and music, essentially, into tricking the gods into making him a god, right?
Right, right. Yeah, there's something that I think Cadmus says in like pagan political theology about the idea of like the difference between a god and something else is a god is someone who can lie and make it so. And like, I feel like poetry is like the one form that very much like you can talk about sorrow and actually make sorrow present in the room. You can lie in a sense about joy, and suddenly joy appears in the room because you're operating on all these different levels to create a reality between you and anyone else who's hearing you.
Oh, I love that. And in a way, it's also like you can lie about sorrow and lie about joy within the poem. You can make joy feel like sorrow in a poem and make sorrow feel like joy, and kind of play this role of the deceiver in that way.
Yeah. I mean, that is the great thing about poetry. Is I think, and like, whenever I talk about poetry with a big capital P, I feel like I should do that with a caveat of like, I'm talking about like English language poetry, especially in America, because that's what I actually know about. So like, this might not be true. But like, at least in the States here, because confessional poetry became so big in the last, 50, 60 years, you know, the idea of like writing from your actual lived experience in this very specific, almost like reportage kind of way. I think there's also, especially now, this prevailing idea that if a poet says something happened, it did. And like, that's just not true. Like, poets lie all the time. I am constantly lying in poems. It is great to do that. And like, but people are expecting the truth out of you. And also facts. And like, so it makes that sort of creation of the world so much more potent. Because people don't take Stephen King at his word. But they will take, you know, they'll take Omotar James at her word. Which actually, she's probably telling the truth most of the time, actually. I think she's actually one of the more factual poets. But maybe I'm wrong. And I don't know. That's the great thing about it.
Yeah, you would never know.
Like, I know Stephen King is lying. Well, actually, Stephen King actually gets it right more than he doesn't, just because I grew up in Maine and all his books are in Maine. And like, if you take out the literal vampires, everything else is basically true.
Yeah, that's why all Lovecraft stuff is based around that region as well. Probably haunted.
It's a wild place. It's an angry place. The trees do not forgive in New England. But great for the leaf peeping, sure, in the fall. New England.
Do you feel like the trees there maybe remember something deeper than what our memory allows?
I don't even, it's weird because it's not even, like growing up there, it was funny because I never quite put my finger on it until I went to California once to like visit somebody. And there's an idea that like the trees there are much less of like, you know, a discrete series of trees. Like, it is very much, they become just a big collective force in New England. So I feel like there's almost the memory of, you know, everything that you have made that is human in New England, at least like in the sort of like, you know, post like 1492 kind of like, you know, like we're going to clear out all these trees and build a house or whatever. It's like, yeah, you've stolen that from the forest. And the forest knows. And the forest is waiting for you to slip up so it can come back and like knock your house over and stick roots through your ribcage and stuff like that. Like the trees are just are very resentful and their time is coming.
It's interesting to me that you grew up in a place where, well, besides the trees just being angry, but that land in and of itself has inspired at least two I guess I would not say that Stephen King is cosmic horror, but there is this like, they're both kind of these men who talk about the intersection between land and madness. And I think that that is the same issue that poets deal with as well. Mm. And in a way that kind of ties to what you were saying about melancholy, because I almost see it as a triangle in which, you know, our body, melancholy, and madness are all creating this focus point, which is the muse of poetry.
Yeah, I would say that. Because, I mean, I think it's funny because, like, melancholy, you know, when we talk about psychological states, I think all of them have some kind of, like, usually, like, some physical component. But depression and sorrow feels like it has the most sort of extreme, maybe like fear in it because like the heart rate and such. But like there's a very extreme kind of physical component to those. And it kind of restores in us, I think, so one of the misconceptions I had about like magic, the occult, spirit work, all that stuff when I first started going was I figured, you know, if you do like an invocation or a summoning and something shows up, there's just going to be a dude in the room there now, you know, like you call upon Abraxas and now there's just a guy with like chicken feet and he's hanging out and he's going to talk to you. And a lot of the stuff is much more like, oh no, there's a feeling in my body right now. And that's the calling card. Or, you know, something has changed, but I perceive it almost on my skin more than I do in some kind of like psychic antennae or whatever. Like you are the instrument through which you are detecting things. Your body is physically the device that tells you what's going on. And I think with poetry, it's the same way. Like you can kind of get a sense of a poem in a somatic way before you really intellectually latched on to what's really happening. Like your little animal shivers are going to tell you a lot more before, you know, your brain in a jar self knows. Sorry, one of my projects is that I think Rene Descartes should be dragged through the streets and mocked. Because like your brain and your mind, they're not separate. It's all intermingled.
Yeah, I completely agree. My bachelor's degree is in philosophy. And I was like an A student in every single one of my classes but modern philosophy, because I argued with the professor about almost every one of his favorite people, including Descartes, because I was just like, what about emotions? Why do none of these philosophers, when they're trying to understand consciousness, account for our emotional state?
Yeah, Descartes.
Yeah. His response was something like, oh, emotions are just like mistakes. I know.
Sorry, keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just think that's hilarious.
No, that's like he was a Kantian, so I think that makes sense that he would feel that way. But, you know, see, he felt that way and he still thinks that he's above them. It's just like weird that modern philosophers will talk about feeling and think that they're talking about something beyond feeling, like they have to be better than their feelings.
I mean, it's also amazing, like the extent to which people who study like, I guess you'd call them like the behavioral disciplines or the kind of like the disciplines that are very much like you're looking at human beings, right? And just like talk about things in a way that really, I think, begs for a kind of self-awareness that might be lacking. Like that whole like emotions are mistakes. That's what I learned when my wife left me. But like, you know, like it's just physician, heal thyself, man. You know, it's right. I feel like if I throw man after something, it's like an apology or something like that because it feels very 60s now.
So I wonder now, like this thought just occurred to me, maybe one of the, besides, you know, the way that East Asian languages are more pictorial, and so then that does create in people who grew up speaking a language that's written as symbol, tends to be more comfortable with non-dualistic thinking than people with, what's the word I'm looking for?
Oh, like phonetically
phonetic, thank you, yes, phonetic system. And if you notice, like, in Buddhist philosophy that has been birthed out of Japan and birthed out of China, Zen Buddhism really relies on poetry to get its lessons out. Whereas people like Descartes or Kant would have thought that poetry was just for the silly little poet boys who are sad and trying to pick up women in the corner, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because I feel like in prose, we always talk about how the virtue is a lack of ambiguity. It's all very specific and discursive. And like with poetry, the whole idea is like you're producing like superpositions. It's not either or, it's both at the same time, and it's neither. Like it just lives to be given the breath of debate and argument and confusion. It's a very moon, it's very much a moon card kind of thing. Whereas like essays, it's funny because like I worked as a copy editor for a long time and I'm still doing it, but like it, you know, it was like much more my like 9-to-5 back when I had a 9-to-5. And when you get dead set on the idea of like trying to make something as clear as possible, there is very much an idea of like you are vivisecting that sentence and it is not going to survive the operation, but you're going to know exactly where every bone goes. Poetry seems to be quite the opposite. We're putting everything in the like sort of the bag of the living being and just shaking it up, and then there it goes.
Yeah, I definitely view poetry as being more akin to a flowing river. And writing an essay is much more like trying to rein in a cloud. Does that make sense?
That is so good. That's cool. Yes. Yes, it's exactly, yeah, putting a lasso around a tornado or something.
Oh, yeah. Especially if you have ADD.
Oh, I bet. Oh, gosh.
Okay, so I guess now I'm wondering, have you ever attempted to write a spell or a ritual or something around your own poetry, or written something poetic simply for use in a working or a ritual of some kind?
I mean, a little bit, right? Like, I think I am very careful with language in those scenarios, like very careful with like connotation and specificity in a way that doesn't feel like directly like writing a poem, but it is sort of like you are pulling in the same bag of skills and awarenesses. I did do a long time ago, I tried to do a poem that was a ritual or a poem that was a spell. It got published by, I want to say, Yes Poetry, because this was a couple years ago, and my mind has kind of melted over the course of being in quarantine for the last 20 years. How long has Corona been going on?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely been at least 20.
Since I was a wee lad. yeah, those things, you can't really separate them out. Like, once you become aware of the way words live and breathe and have wills of their own, you can't kind of put that away. Or maybe you can. I don't know. Maybe if I took drinking again. But for the most part, like that's just living in you forever. But I also kind of like, I don't know, something I've been investigating recently that I think would be very, that I want to do more of is also like inviting spirits in when writing. Mm-hmm. Too. Because like I've been fixating a lot, especially on spirit conjuration as part of 20th and 21st century poetic writing practice in like America, right? So like people like you know, James Merrill, who got a Pulitzer for a book that included, you know, things that were dictated to him by the spirit of a guy who died in, I believe, 63 AD, right? And he was just doing things with a Ouija board.
I love that concept.
Yeah. He ended up doing like a three-book series and contained in a single book called The Changing Light at Sandover. But it was like him just doing a Ouija board with his partner, with the two of them sitting at the table with, I think, one mirror or two mirrors facing both of them so that the spirit could see them and respond. So you've got like that being a huge thing. And like, it sounds like a kind of a fringe thing to do. But of course, he gets the Pulitzer and then keeps the Pulitzer in his kitchen, like very mainstream work. And then you've got Jack Spicer, who was this like San Francisco poet in like the 60s, who did this whole book of poems that were Lorca translations, but there is a foreword from Lorca that is saying, you know, I'd like to thank Jack Spicer for writing, for translating these poems, including some poems I wrote after I died, but I have noticed that some of these are just him. Because, you know, Lorca had been dead for 20, 30 years. And you'll find, like, I think when Spicer was sort of, you know, in the final kind of spiral of his life, because he had a lot of alcohol issues, and I think never really had, you know, classic poet, you know, drinking all the time, never had two quarters to rub together. And so some friends basically put together a lecture series to give him money. And like, as part of the lecture series, he's like, yeah, you know, when you're writing, there's something that's talking through you. And the less you interfere with the thing that is talking through you, the better the poem is going to be. So just try to really step out of the way of the thing. And like the metaphor he uses is Martians. Martians are talking to you through like an antenna. But like, we're talking about a guy who basically did like an explicitly necromantic poetry book. So I feel like it's also ghosts, but it could be anything, right?
Yeah. Alan Moore does a lot of talking about how poets kind of, because they live on the intersection between madness and, you know, sanity, and they have one foot in reality and one foot in the liminal, that they tend to be more predisposed to being occultists, but also just predisposed to being good diviners, being good at sea spirits, again, because they have one foot in the liminal and one foot here. And in his book, Jerusalem, there was a guy that's exactly like who you're talking about. He was a poet. He was a drunk. He couldn't keep money. He was like surviving off of people who loved him, because all he would do all day is just drink and write poetry. But he would see ghosts and not be able to tell that they were ghosts. He thought that they were just regular people. And then he would just have conversations with them, and they would inevitably inspire more of the poetry that he would write. So it does seem like this is a recursive theme enough for multiple people to notice the validity of this. Drinking spirits to see spirits, and being a poet and living in the liminal. And if you can do all those at once, you may be a little bit mad, but you'll be very good at seeing spirits and communing with them.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, right? Because I feel like we've been talking about Hermes, and like, I think the classic planetary ruler of a poet is probably Mercury. And that makes perfect sense, especially because so many poets, at least in the Western tradition, are like, you know, oh, woe is me, I'm going to go on the fainting couch. And they can't keep money together, and they are, you know, dealing with madness or melancholy or all these things. Like, they are very Saturnine figures, which like really, I think, lends itself not only to like necromancy, but also to this kind of liminality, right? Because Saturn is the great gatekeeper, which I guess Mercury is, you know, the transversor of boundaries. And then the moon, you know, is also this kind of liminal thing. It's enough to like, really, if you want to think really hard about it, it's a great way to spend an afternoon just kind of fixating on like the moon goes through a cycle every 28 days. Saturn goes through a cycle every 28 years or so. Like, are they really just sort of, you know, talking to each other? Where does the heart live in between those two things? Sure. You know, where is fancy bread in the heart or in the head of what born, what nourished shed, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think about Hermes would in some ways be a subservient to Saturn, and that Hermes and Mercury would act as a messenger to any of the higher gods, right, so to speak. So Saturn may kind of create the playing field, create the boundaries, but Hermes, Mercury would then be the tool that fills the boundaries. And the moon maybe is like the ink with which Mercury writes.
Totally. You know, if you look at, like, say, Wordsworth, right, saying that poetry is essentially a moment of great, like, emotion recalled at some point in further on, right? Like, it's always an act of memory. It's always an act of bringing back from the past. And you have things like Shakespeare doing all these sonnets that are about how, as long as these lines live and are read, so too will you live, this person that I am writing about. Like, poetry as specifically the preservative of an emotion, right? And it feels very much like the kind of psychopompic work that Mercury does. Like, there's this sort of story of Hermes where I'm gonna get the details botched, but like the essential narrative is that there is someone who is talking about how so much they miss their dead beloved, and so Mercury brings them back for a single day, and then they disappear. And the horror of having it for a moment and then gone again is too much for this person, and they end up, I think, killing themselves. But like, this sense that poetry is specifically not just the preservation of the past, but the preservation of the past in emotion, mm-hmm. you know, really keeping the smells of the moment more than the actual explicit physical details, I think really captures perhaps this mercurial journey from like Saturn to the moon and back again.
Yes, it's kind of tying into what we were saying at the beginning of the episode about poetry being the ability to capture ghosts of past memories and past emotions. And it is in that way, like Hermes bringing the dead out from the underworld, and then we're kind of bottling it up and then showing it to everybody else, like, look what I caught. How does this make you feel?
Wow, that is really what, yeah, like, that is the experience of doing a poetry reading, right? Is you're going up in front of a room of people, holding up a little bottle of your bad feelings and being like, look at it! Look at it! Now please politely clap. Gosh, I miss doing poetry readings. That is one of the great sorrows of the pandemic, is there just aren't, I mean, people have been doing them over, like, Zoom and stuff like that, but, like, the actual experience of going in front of a room of flesh and blood people and doing, like, a big emotional thing and then having, like, no feedback whatsoever, like, just silence afterwards, like, there is such joy in that abjection. Really do miss it.
Do you feel like in those moments you can almost sense the feedback in, like, the way that the moisture in the air makes your body feel? You know what I mean? Like, you can just tell in some ways how people are responding, even in silence.
I mean, maybe someone who has less stage fright than I do could. Because I think like, I get a very sort of tunnel vision kind of experience of doing it, which is maybe why, I mean, that's almost exactly why, like, I tended to approach poetry readings as stand-up comedy. Like, you need to sort of go up there and, like, get the reassurance of, like, a direct response. Because, like, most times when people do, at least at most of the venues, like, I've read out, like, if people respond to the poem, they'll respond to all the poems at the end with, like, clapping or something like that, right? Like, you get nothing in the middle. Mm-hmm. But if you can get people to laugh, like, you get something and you feel like, okay, I've broken through some kind of wall of terror that is emanating from my own body. I've exercised myself in this way. I don't know. Like, I feel like it's probably a limitation, right? Because it means that the work is always working, looking for some kind of encouragement. But at the same time, it also makes it much more of like a direct experience of like, no, we're all in a room together. We're not all having our separate little emotional moments. We're having our big emotional moment together right now.
Yeah, I think you just touched on something. We like to say it doesn't matter what other people think, but what is the point of art? Why do we make art if not to be seen, if not to know if somebody else is seeing us?
Yeah.
And how that makes them feel. And it doesn't have to be an ego thing. I think that's a capitalist mindset mistake. It's like we think that we want validation so that we can bolster our egos, but maybe we just want validation so that we can connect with our community and to be able to distinguish between what it is you actually desire and why you want recognition is a part of the process that the poet or any artist struggles with, because they both want, obviously, for people to like what they do, but they still want to be authentic. And how can they do that safely for them and for others? Some people don't care about doing it safely for others, but I do.
Yeah. It's reminding me of, like, I'm doing like a social work degree right now, and I was reading this paper last semester for one of my classes about different kinds of styles of conversation that can happen in, like, a therapy session, right? And the sort of, like, gold standard, like, the thing you're supposed to want if you're doing therapy with somebody is what was called as, like, commensal communication, where the idea is the two of you as, like, therapist and patient are holding up this third thing between you. and you're giving it form and shape and you're investigating it, but you're also kind of, I think there's a feeling of like creating it too. And so like art really can do that if you do it successfully aside. It's not that you're even being seen, but the two of you are both, you found a way for you and another person to see the same thing, whether it's you or something else, which can be a way of like, I mean, I'm thinking of it like, you know, back when we were talking at the very beginning of this about like when I was in Hong Kong and I was like, you know, I would be very lonely and isolated and I was reading these poems and reading them to myself out loud, you know, and this sense that like, it's not even that I was seeing those dead poets or that they were seeing me, but that between the triangulation of me and the poem, I was able to see something in myself. And in being able to actually see the emotions or the feelings or the scenario for what it really was, there was a sense that it could be communicated with on its own terms as well. That like, there was a sense of not being, of not drowning in the thing, but being able to actually talk to it through the triangulation of like, the self and the work, if that makes sense.
No, totally. That almost made me think of emotions as separate spirits or energy waves in within the material reality that kind of blow through us and tickle our body in the same way that the wind does, that it creates a response in us, but it's also something that exists outside of us. And maybe that's what makes it so hard, again, because emotions are more like water. So how do you pin water down? And if I can't pin it down, how can I understand what's happening to me?
Yeah, it's like a, it's like an infrared wave or something, right? Where if you like have like heat coming off of a star, say, you know, as it goes through the vacuum of space, there's nothing there. So there's nothing getting heated. But you need for that heat to actually truly, even if it exists outside of the objects that it cooks, it cannot actually exist until it has something to affect in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess is sort of, you know, in a lot of ways, like what being human is. Like, do we exist until we are affecting something, even if that thing is ourselves? You know, there's that whole... what's his name? G.H. Meade, whole business about like, even when you're thinking, all you're really doing is creating a conversation that you're having with somebody else. And the other person's inside of you too. But like, that's how we're actually capable of perceiving things, including ourselves. A person's idea of themselves is like a person, a self is an object described by a person inside of you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the self is transient, right? In the same way that our emotions are, because as memories flux and as our way of experiencing emotions flux, the way that our selfhood is experienced and expressed also is in flux. And then this brings me back to that idea of using a poem to capture a memory or capture emotion, like a bottle suspended throughout time, because I may have changed and myself may have changed, but I have this poem that's kind of a fixture saying this is who I was, or in that moment at that time, whatever it was when I wrote it.
Right. And especially because like that capturing can feel very much like a, it's funny because like if you think of it as like sort of like making a statue for a spirit to live in, like a little spirit house, right? It doesn't even have to like be reflective of the moment. It's just sort of, you're constantly kind of like checking back with whatever like feeling this is, or whatever spirit is talking to you in some way, you know, like, is this right? Is this the shape? What if I move the nose a little bit over here? Is that right? Does that feel like that that's actually where you are? Like, is it connecting? And like that kind of checking back, it's very liberatory to be able to ask things of your experiences instead of just having them.
Yes. Oh, I love that idea. Each kind of slice of time is both a part of us and separate from us. So in that way, we can communicate with experiences just as much as we could communicate internally within ourselves.
Yeah, like it is amazing to sort of look at yourself and be like, who's in there? Is anybody in there? Are a lot of people in there? Yeah, because like there's that idea of like, music, I forget who said this, but like music is a way of decorating time, right? But poetry is the same thing. It's a way of like interacting with time. I don't know. It's kind of like I'm working right now in a clinic for people with like substance use issues, right? So I'm leading group therapy sessions. I'm doing one-on-one stuff with a lot of guys who have been struggling with addiction for a lot of them, it seems like, for years and years. And one of the things they keep bringing up is this idea that, like, you know, if you start really feeling like you're gonna use again, the metaphor they use is that, like, you know, play the tape back for yourself. You know, like, remember the last time you used and like sit through that entire experience. So not just like the euphoria and the joy, but also like all the negative consequences that came after it and all the things that made you start trying not to do this anymore. And that idea of like poetry as essentially, it's almost like if you had like a tape of like, you know, an experience, but because it's like a cassette tape, for it to play again, it needs to move through the air. And the air is always going to be different, right? Like the weather is going to affect how the sound comes out. So like it's preservation, but it's also, it's, you know, it's repertoire and it's performance. It's the staging of the play every single night. And it's not the same play every single night.
It was making me think about how when you go see a musical and you go see it on the first night, there is a different feel than if you go and see it on the closing show. Energy levels are different. Maybe they've worked some things out and the blocking is a bit different. Maybe that one singer is feeling more confident than they were on the first night. Maybe there's another singer who's blown their voice out a little bit. And it is, like you pointed out, that we interpret sound differently based off of the wind and the pressure in the air and the moisture level and how cold it is. So there's that level of changing it too. So even though the structure and the content is the same for every single one of the performances, what the audience receives emotively may be drastically different from show to show.
Truly. Yeah, nothing is ever the same, no matter how well we preserve it, which is kind of beautiful, right? Because it means that everything, even copies, even recordings, even, you know, stone, is deeply alive because it is still always changing and malleable.
Yeah, it's like Heraclitus said, you can't step in the same river twice. You know, our bodies are basically passageways for rivers of blood and rivers of plasma and rivers of water. And so there's this material evidence of this metaphorical truth that even ourself is transient. And poetry also being related to water, I do truly feel like there is more truth to the liminal than simply existing in the material at all times.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you talk about the liminal, do you feel like there is a kind of collective will or consciousness to the liminal? Or does it feel like just a category? Like, is there a way to interact with the liminal in a way where it feels like the liminal is really somehow interacting with you? Can the liminal be an old friend?
I feel like yes. I feel like the liminal is both a space. I see it a lot like Dream's kingdom in Sandman, how there are different places that you could go to happenstancely. You don't really mean to end up anywhere, but maybe you're in Fiddler's Green, or maybe you're in, you know, the biblical narrative or the biblical myths zone or whatever. So there is a place, I think, where there's a collective consciousness, and then there are places that are more only hidden recesses for our individual consciousness, or maybe we can lend the key to somebody else to meet us there in dreams. But absolutely, I would say that the liminal can be our friend, because that's what I'm engaged with when I write poetry. I really loved what you said earlier about you can't think about the poem, you have to just let it come.
Yeah.
because I feel like that is the intersection between, obviously, I'm saying something, I'm using words with poetry, so it's not nearly as abstract as, you know, maybe just a song on its own without lyrics. There's something more concrete about a poem, but if you put too much thought in it, I think it becomes prose.
Yeah.
Like it changes from being a poetry to being some sort of artistic representation of prose that's maybe not quite a short story, but still more similar to a story than a poem, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I write poetry, I kind of just visualize my heart opening. And I don't know if my poems are like good, but I basically just visualize my heart opening and then I just let words flow out without trying to impose anything on them. And I see what happens and maybe I'll tweak some of it with my, I have an air moon, so it's impossible for me to not bring the analytic into it, but that's like for the editing stage, you know, that initial like get the words out, get the feeling out. I want to be as removed from my logic brain as much as possible while still being engaged with words. So I need to be friends with the liminal in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. That is like, also like, I feel like editing is like that weird trap, right? Cause it's so easy to decide that you know what you want the poem to do instead of listening to what the poem wants to do. Which can be a very hard thing to hear. But again, like it's that idea of never treating a room as though it's empty, like seeing what the room wants. Because it's interesting, like when we are editing our own work, like are you engaging with that as like a past version of yourself? Are you engaging with that as like an entity that is there before you? Or is it almost like a field? Like you're trying to like hear what the field is doing collectively. Like what is the meadow if you take this flower out or put this flower in instead?
Mm-hmm. In some ways, depends on the poem, depends on what you want from the poem. But generally speaking, I view it as a conversation with a friend. Because it's like the first thing that comes out is my truth as expressed liminally with my friend. And then now I go back and it's almost like I'm reading my friend's words. And I'm saying, well, I would maybe put this word here instead of that word, or, you know, I would maybe add this symbology that made me think of a myth that I know. And now yeah. I want to add in a little bit about that myth that isn't inspired by the liminal space. That's inspired by my knowledge of myth, which is still a Mercury thing, but more on the air side. You know, and then it's almost as if me and my friend are working together. I don't know, though, if that friend is another version of me or something different. I don't have a firm cosmological belief about those sorts of things.
Yeah. I mean, I love that way of putting it, right? Because, like, that's such a great idea of, like, you're not, you know, the poet is not, like, Prospero, like commanding the forces of the poem, like this mountain shall be a river now. It's like really just like a polite suggestion to someone you care about of like, I love what you're doing here. Have you considered? Which, you know, to neither rule nor be ruled by the poem.
Yes. And it's a fine line.
Yeah. Yeah. How do we do mutual aid with the poem? How do we become anarchists of the poem? Oh man, that's, ooh. That might be the thing that finally, over the course of the entire pandemic, I've been sort of shifting politically from like a very strong communist perspective, much more of an anarchist thing. And I think that might be, maybe poetry is the thing that finally pushes me over the wall and like, okay, decentralize everything forever. Hooray. I don't know.
I will say to me, just as a person who has a lot of Saturn in me, there is something scary to me about removing the structure of the poem, as if that would give full rein to the madness, which, if you think about it, some of the best poets, unfortunately, have descended so much into madness that they've lost themselves. They've lost their connection and their grounding to this world, which in the most extreme cases can result in suicide. And on the other end of the most extreme case, hospitalization, just because maybe they are scaring everyone else. If there was a way to decentralize the poem while maintaining structure. And it's funny because I did the exact opposite as you over the pandemic. I was much more of an anarchist before the pandemic, and now I'm kind of leaning more into communism, which is really just because I don't know that the world is ready to be rid of structure yet. I want to believe in that idea, but people do not have enough control over the liminal and over their emotions. Most people want to pretend like that doesn't even exist. So then how do you teach them to engage in that safely without the rails just, you know, not giving them the ability to even fall off the edge?
Right. I mean, that is the classic sort of communist idea that like anarchism is the end goal, but you need to like create the ground conditions for it. Right. And like that question of can you hold on to that project without using it as a way to fall into the trap of like consistently pushing the stage of readiness farther and farther away from you, because it's never quite, it's, you know, like, oh, we almost did it, but like that, now we need 10 more years to do this. It is interesting because like I feel like poetry is itself providing structure to air. It is like, it is a kind of, you know, binding of the spirits of the air, which does feel like a very kind of, it's funny because like the Western esoteric tradition in general, right? It's always, as much as it treats itself as like a separate undercurrent to everything else that's going on, it is of course deeply affected by, I think, the political ideologies of the time, right? Like, not to make everything about Al Cummins, though we could because he's wonderful and I love him, but like, you know, he does make this good point, I think, in talking about an excellent book of The Art of Magic, that like, you know, it's a grimoire written by people who did colonialism, and there's a very strong sort of like colonial expropriative, you know, abusive kind of like worldview in there. And then like, you know, I think at one point Phil Hine was doing an interview about chaos magic somewhere, and he said, you know, we were doing this during Thatcher, and like the neoliberal sort of Thatcherist ideology is very deeply imbued in chaos magic. Like it sort of has at the root that notion. And like, I feel like
there's a libertarian tinge to chaos magic sometimes.
Definitely. And like, I feel like poetry is sort of the same way, maybe, where it feels like it's trying to be a separate place in the world, but it can't quite remove itself from how the world applies structure. Right, because even libertarianism, with all its sort of, you know, open-endedness, is an attempt to apply a structure to the world. It's just a very sort of open-ended structure that's based on, you know, very limited sets of property rights or something like that. I wonder, like, I don't know, do you feel like when you write poetry, do you feel as though the world is creeping in a lot with that? Or do you feel like you're creating a separate space for yourself? Is poetry utopian?
Okay, so this is what I was thinking, actually, as you were talking, is that maybe poetry is the key to this issue. Even communists who say, well, our way should only be temporary, as like a way between capitalism to anarchy. But then every time communism has ever been tried in the real world, it's devolved into fascism. And Paulo Freire talks about all of this in his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And what he brings up is you have to recognize that you embody within yourself, each and every one of us. It doesn't matter whether you identify as an oppressor or the oppressed class. You actually have both within you. You have an oppressed body and you have an oppressor body. And I feel like poetry can be the bridge that helps us, you know, I'm almost thinking of like Hedwig and the Angry Inch and the idea of the man who, or the human who broke off into man and woman, where there once was a monad, there is now a dyad. How can we bridge the oppressor and the oppressed together to create something new that is an independent human that is strong within its own kingdom, but still compassionate and not acting as an oppressive force upon the other, so that I can obtain my personal autonomous freedom while still allowing the other to have autonomous freedom, and there's no conflict between us.
Right.
I feel like any sort of practice in the liminal space can give us the ability to bridge these dualistic entities within us that kind of battle each other and create anxiety and create depression within us, even if we're not aware that there is these battles even going on.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, because poetry really does live in the kind of the realm of ambiguity, which I think is the thing that scares people specifically about like their own freedom and other people's freedoms, right? It's the idea of just not knowing. It's the uncertainty. And so giving people time to really live in uncertainty and see the productive joy of it, like, you know, that classic, you know, there's that old story about Robert Frost, right, where somebody goes up to him, like a reporter or something, and talks to him about Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, that poem that's, you know, the one that ends, you know, like the woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. And says, you know, like very clearly, like, oh, this poem is clearly about like not committing suicide. What was the thing that kept the speaker from committing suicide? What was the thing he had to do before he went to sleep? And, you know, Robert Frost, in the story that I'm sure is probably apocryphal or something, he goes like, oh, no, like it's not, he was far from his house. And so he had to go like maybe 2-3 miles before he could be in his bed, because that's where it was. And like that idea of like, oh, well, this is just proof that Robert Frost doesn't own his poem, that nobody owns anything. But like living in that idea that like no one gets to have final say on something, that even like a consensus doesn't quite do it, right? It's hard. Yeah, so like maybe poetry is that bridge. That's great. I love that. We need more Marxist poets.
We do. That made me think about how people expected memes to be the free agent of internet leftism. You know, the memes are always free. You can always share a meme. And there was this idea in the first couple of years of memeing in which it didn't matter if you credited this person who made the memes. But then people started getting social capital from memeing, and they started to figure out ways to use that social capital to leverage power or leverage their finances.
Yeah.
And over time, memes kind of became something that was now owned by late stage capitalism and no longer functioned as a leftist tool, because now we have to credit who made the meme. It's not free anymore. And, you know, like, it's not that we want to not credit the poet, but there is, I think, an embedded knowledge in all of us that no poet owns their poem, because it can be hard for anybody to understand what the poem really means. And you have to kind of sit and meditate on it and allow the meaning to bubble up out of you, which makes it a wholly personal experience. So you can go to a poetry critique class and have somebody tell you what it means, but you can reject that and tell the entire class that you reject that, and nobody's going to tell you that you're wrong. So there is an opening of freedom within poetry that I find you only get in maybe poetry, and I would also say probably abstract art.
Yeah. It's interesting, right? Because there's a sense with all that, that the poem itself, the painting itself, that whatever it is itself, is available for all these interpretations, because it is so separate from everyone else. It can fend for itself. And I feel like this idea of, can we be brave enough to leave our own experiences to fend for themselves, is a question that I think poetry seeks to answer. And I don't know if it has a good answer for it. But that takes us off the realm of politics. So it is also, it's interesting, like that idea of like, I feel like it's funny, because I saw, before we started talking, I was like, you know, looking at my phone, as one does. And apparently there is I don't use TikTok because it makes me feel significantly older than I already am. And I'm already pretty old, but it makes me feel ancient. But maybe it'd be good as mercury remediation because of how fast everything goes. But apparently there's a dust up in a cult TikTok because somebody, or there's maybe a Discord server or something where they're posting a list of the forbidden TikTok occultists, because they're with lists of what their TikTok crimes are. Which is, and I was looking through it to be so what are the things that get you yelled at on Discord about your TikTok? And apparently one of them is just talking too much about your own unconfirmed personal gnosis. And I think that idea of being brave enough to say my experiences with, I don't know, Aphrodite or the ghost of Winston Churchill or this Archon or whatever, being able to be people can totally tell me I'm wrong about that, but I know what I know, and I don't need people to agree with me on that. I feel like poetry could also be good practice for that, though. I feel at this point now we're also being what are the uses of poetry, which honestly, I don't know, does it need defending? Maybe it does.
I mean, I think that the use of it is to see oneself more clearly. Because like we were saying, emotions are hard to pin down, so the self is hard to pin down. But we can at least maybe write a poem and capture at least who we were in that moment of experience. It becomes like a looking glass into the self. It can also be used as a way to help you become more comfortable with the liminal, which means the unknown, like you were saying. And this goes back to politics again, right? Because none of these things that I've mentioned actually matter under capitalist terms. They don't actually help you be a better worker or help you be a better capitalist. But they do help you become a better human, which in and of itself is anti-capitalist work, to allow yourself to embody comfortability in the unknown. Returns power back to the self.
Yeah. To have all these bits of you that you can't sell.
Uh-huh.
But still letting those inefficiencies survive within you.
Yeah, because who wants to buy poetry these days?
Yeah. I mean, there's that old joke that all poetry books are just poets handing the same $20 back to each other over and over again. And it really does kind of feel like that. But you know what? It works.
I mean, we do the same thing in a cult, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, but I guess I feel like that's more sustainable in the occult because those books are just so much more expensive a lot of the time. You know,
that's true, too.
So who knows? I've never actually published an occult book. I don't know if the authors get a better cut than the poetry folks do.
Why not a book of occult poetry?
That'd be kind of fun. I mean, there are a lot of folks doing it, and they're doing it with a great deal of success. Tedesco not too long ago put out a book of poems that were inspired by her trying to talk to Lizzie Borden through a Ouija board. And I feel like, if she's doing something that cool, why can't I do something super cool too? Who knows what it would be? I mean, apparently H.P. Lovecraft used to live in this neighborhood, so maybe I'll try to talk to him and do some poems about that. Though he seems like he wouldn't be fun to hang out with.
I feel like your dreams would become really horrifying if you opened that door. And I mean, it could be a good practice of becoming comfortable in the uncomfortable, but it's also, it would be an interesting thing to openly will into your life.
Yeah, it would certainly, it would, I feel like there'd be a point where, you'd have these dreams where H.P. Lovecraft is yelling at you for interacting with an Iberian or something. You'd be like, I brought this on myself. This was an own goal. There's a racist man in my dreams and I did this entirely to myself.
Yes. Yes. I'm loving this idea now. I am seeing poetry as a necromantic art in particular.
Oh, deeply, deeply, deeply.
And do you feel like you can communicate with ghosts and spirits of the dead more easily through poetic language than analytical language?
That is a thing that I'm working on now. So I don't have any definite ideas on my own experience of it, but I think there's a through line in this through a lot of magical work, just sort of in general, right? This sense that we must become a spirit, or that there's sympathy, right? That you develop a sympathy. And I think poetic language is much better at developing a sympathy because it is denotation and connotation together. It is it is words and it is melody and lyrics together. And so you're just going to have a more total package. And like analytic language, like you can, I mean, I feel like the big dirty secret of analysis or empiricism is always that it's actually not that precise. Like it presumes a lot of like, you know, when I say this word, we all know what it means. And it doesn't actually try to make that happen. It just says, no, we all went to college. We all know that this word means this. It's like, that's not terribly effective.
No, and in fact, philosophy of language has since disproven that theory. Not very many philosophers who study language believe that there is a one-to-one meaning embedded in the word use anymore.
You know, that's the, like, this isn't exactly necromantic, but I feel like it's not too far afield. But like, if you ever get access to like the Oxford Historic English Dictionary, the idea that a single word will have centuries and centuries of doing different things and living different lives, you know, every noun is just a little David Bowie going on a journey of selves for, you know, from Old Norse through Middle English to modern, you know, the things we say on the internet to each other where we don't use all the letters, you know, like it just, nothing's ever static. It's the Heraclitus again. Heraclitus was right.
Oh yeah.
Heraclitus was right. Descartes was wrong. And I think that's the final scoreboard.
Yeah, I definitely think that we should go back and complain to whoever idea it was to develop the Cartesian model.
Yeah, worthy necromantic working would be to call up Descartes and just yell at him.
All I really want to do is bring their spirits back so that I can tell them how dumb they were. But maybe I'm not at that level of necromancy yet where that would be safe.
I mean, it's funny, like you know, one of the books I read this year that I really loved was Theo Brown's The Fate of the Dead, right? Which is this book where Theo Brown is looking at, basically, you know, like once the Reformation sweeps through England and purgatory is essentially destroyed in the sort of cosmology of the popular religious beliefs there. This idea of like, what happens to ghosts after that? Because people are still like having experiences of seeing ghosts, but now they have no sort of like religious framework for like where they live, why they're there. And so like there's just all this stuff about like the records of like people trying to do exorcisms. And I bring this up just because I feel like there is a wealth of techniques in there for like, what happens if you get Descartes too mad at you? And the answer, of course, is throw grave dirt at his face and either he'll disappear or maybe turn into a horse.
Oh my gosh, I want a Descartes horse.
That, I mean, like, it would certainly, if Descartes is a horse that you could ride, would make him way more useful than he's ever been as a philosopher. There. Haha. I've already started laying into him. Let's see if this will summon his ghost to like yell at me. But like, I don't know. Like, I feel like this is sort of a side note, but I want to recommend this book just also because there's a lot of joy in it about like the idea of just ghosts as a problem that never quite goes away. So like a lot of the traditional methods of dealing with like a haunting is to give a ghost a task that will presumably take forever, but actually is somehow finite. So like, you know, you can't come back to the house until you've gathered every single grain of sand from this beach. And that's like a lot. That's going to take a long time, but there's only so many. And then you're done. And maybe that's sort of like just kicking the can down the road, right? Of like, well, this isn't going to be my problem. This is going to be somebody else's problem. But it's still like this idea, these are tensions that are never resolved. No exorcism is final.
Yeah, so it's basically like you're saying, whoever lives in this house after me has to deal with a haunting, but I don't have to deal with a haunting. Okay, but so then how do you feel about things like the headless rite that are meant to be something that can exorcise both the self, places, and other people?
I mean, my sense of like, you know, I'm no expert or anything, but my feeling about a lot of exorcisms and clearings and banishings and all that sort of stuff is you're saying, well, here's a place where you go away. And like, if you're very successful, it does go away. But, you know, it's just somewhere else now. You know, if you kick someone out of the bar at closing time, they don't disappear. And eventually you're going to open the bar back up and maybe they'll show up. Maybe they won't. I mean, maybe they won't just because like, you know, I feel like, you know, as complicated and difficult as spirit stuff could be, it's like, I presume if someone yells at you enough, you're like, I'm not going to go back there. The vibes are off.
Yeah.
Every time I go into the house on Haunted Hill, everyone yells at me. So I'm just going to stop, which it is funny because like, I feel like I've never been present at a Catholic exorcism, but I get the sense it's not nearly as like harsh as a lot of other forms of banishing are, right? Like, it's a lot of sort of like, you know, here are some names, go away. It's never like it's not terribly insulting, it doesn't seem like. And so I'm wondering if maybe that's why every parish needs an exorcist, because they're not being mean enough.
Yeah, I think Catholic exorcisms are more just like praising God and then hoping that that scares the spirit away, because it doesn't want to be near the praising of God's name.
That would kind of work for me, right? Like, if someone, like, not with God's name or anything, but like, if someone was just like, you know, if someone was like, hey, I'm going to talk about crypto for 40 minutes, I'd be like, oh, I guess it's time to hit the bricks for me. Like, I don't feel compelled. I'm like, I'm not being forced to leave, but I feel compelled.
Yes, totally. Yeah, I agree with that completely. It made me think about something that one of my gurus in India, when I was studying in an ashram there, said about, you have to empty the cup to fill the cup.
Hmm.
So if I empty myself, maybe let's say I wake up and I do the headless to like self-exercise me for the day, and then I pray some sort of, you know, invocation that would fill me up with something of divine light, then there is no more room within the cup for anything that I was exercising out.
Yeah.
And actually, that is what the headless is, because it's invoking the cosmic deity into yourself so that you and the cosmic deity become one there for a second.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, because that's also sort of, I think it's very standard practice if you're doing, like, to go back to like Catholicism for like a hot second, but like if you do like the Asparagus May, you know, the thing, the cleansy thing, you usually follow up with like with a Gloria Patri to like fill that space back up.
So it's almost as if our bodies are vessels.
Yeah, I mean, we are, I mean, if anything, are we not just, you know, like, possession is a great metaphor for it, because it does feel like you're possessing your own body. And it's just that you've got the firmest possession, you know, you've got the deed, but other people might show up as well. But like, you're the one who's actually, if you're not the one with the most right to the house, this is the house that you have the most right to. So that's where you're going to linger. But actually, speaking of banishing, I should probably go. But this has been a real joy. Thank you for this.
Oh, yeah, no problem. This was a great conversation. It flew by, and I will surely talk to you soon on the Instagrams, I'm sure.
Oh, totally.
All right. Well, you have a great rest of your day, Cooper, and thank you again for joining us.
You too. Thank you so much. This was really a pleasure.